Off the Ball, GAA.
It's still fairly raw to lose an All-Ireland final, but to not hit the levels that we had had all year and the biggest day of the year was probably the hardest thing to take.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
39 Irish women are playing in the AFLW this year, which is a new record. But how did they make the leap from Gaelic football to Australia? Today we spoke to Mike Curran of AFLW Ireland. Before we get into your role as elite coaching and talent ID, I'd love to ask you how you got into AFL as a passion and an interest in the first place.
Wow, that goes back a long way now at this stage. We don't have time to cover everything, but I've been involved, I suppose, in AFL for 25 years at this stage. I'm going way back to when I left West Clare to go to uni in Dublin, and I just had a love of AFL, which was very weird at the time. It used to be broadcast on a highlight show every Saturday night here at home, like something crazy, 11 p.m. or something. I used to stay up religiously to watch that, and used to play Gaelic football at home myself up to minor level. Then I went to college, obviously hours away from home, so I wasn't getting back in that, and just one day I saw a sign on a notice board, like there was no internet or any of that back then, so like literally a post-it note from an Aussie guy saying, did anyone want to have a kick of a footy? And I said, yeah, absolutely, I'm down for that, you know. So I went along to that. There was two or three of us the first day, the next day there was 20 of us, the next day there was 40 of us, and it just literally took off from there, as you know. So from that point on, first or second year in college, I kind of got actively involved in, you know, setting up a local league here in Ireland. I set up an Irish national team. I actually set up a European Australian rules board, which went on to become AFL Europe. So it just grew from there, literally, you know. A few years later, then I played for a lot of years myself, had some great opportunities, got to go to Australia 3 times playing international footy. And when that was all over and done with, I suppose I stayed involved coaching the Irish men's national team, helping my brother Brian out, who was the men's head coach at the time. And then naturally, it got to a stage where in 2017, AFLW was born as a competition, I suppose, a really new concept at the time, really exciting, probably started 2 or 3 years ahead of when it would have been initially planted due to just the increasing interest in women's sport in general. And I suppose from that point on, I automatically saw there was an opportunity here for Irish girls to get involved in this competition at a very early stage, and was involved in a number of initiatives at the start of that competition, you know, with the initial players going over some recruitment camps here in Ireland, some recruitment camps in Australia. And then we had COVID, the famous full stop on everything. So at that point then, I suppose there was kind of a defined break in everything, and from then forward, I wasn't really involved actively in anything in terms of the national teams here anymore. I focused fully on professional AFLW and elite female athletes in Ireland and helping those girls to go over and to get connected with clubs and to secure contracts. So from that point on, I suppose, in the first AFLW season in 2017, there was one Irish player. And this year in 2025, we have 39. So it's an incredible progression.
And when you joined at the start in college, were you the only Irish person? Was it you and a group of Aussies?
There was 2 Irish and 1 Aussie, and then it was there was a lot more Aussies in Ireland at the time, obviously, and the numbers dwindled again a few years after that. But there was huge interest from the Irish boys. You know, we started a club team in Dublin, and we quickly had 30 or 40 members. There might have been 7 or 8 Aussies, and the rest were Irish guys. But I just loved those interactions with the Australian players at the start. You know, it's like totally different how they go about their business on a football field, I suppose. You know, their enthusiasm, there's a lot more talk, there's a lot more encouragement. All the Irish players over there now will tell you that as well. It's nearly a bit of a culture shock, you know.
Yeah, the culture is so different.
Yeah, you're getting high fives.
Is that what kind of drew you to it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's amazing, like just this positive energy. I suppose it was a new sport, there was no preconceptions or no politics or anything involved, and people came at loads of different levels and just took part in it, you know. So some of those early Australian players and coaches that I had really influenced me in terms of that, and I, from that point on, I suppose I've always tried to bring that enthusiasm and positivity to anyone that I'm working with and helping them to go to Australia and preparing them for what's ahead.
And so did you spend much time in Australia yourself?
So literally I've been over and back. At the moment I go over every year for work with the clubs and stuff like that, but on 3 different tours I was there playing for 3 weeks at a time, and stayed on 1 or 2 of those for a few extra weeks myself. I've never lived in Australia for a defined period of time, but I've been over and back multiple times.
Just born with the graw for it, so.
Yeah, exactly, and that's just increased.
And so your role as talent ID and, you know, coach, can you talk us through the process of recruiting players from Ireland over to the AFLW, and obviously the evolution of it over the last, you know, 8 years has been incredible.
Yeah, I suppose there's a couple of different elements to it. Obviously, there's the talent ID side, where I will identify a player that I think will be suitable for AFLW or has attributes that will be in demand from certain clubs. There's also a scenario where we get contacted by players who are asking, I love this, how can I get involved? You know, how can I try out for it effectively? So there's kind of a combination of both of those.
What would the mix be like in percentages between the two?
It's a lot more recently, it's balanced out. Obviously, it would always be the talented E is the main aspect of it, you know, but the number of people that would be contacting us initially and reaching out has increased a lot over the last number of years. That's probably proportionate to the amount of Irish players over there and the awareness of the sport and I suppose the general increase in interest in that. But yeah, I guess primarily, obviously, the talent ID is the main part of it. You know, you're generally identifying players that you think have potential to play the sport. We also have scenarios then where clubs will have specific requirements. So the AFLW club will come to me and tell me that I need a fast, speedy wing back or someone that can play forward that's a natural goal scorer. Or a lot of the time they're looking for like a taller player that can play like a central defence. So in certain circumstances, clubs will have a requirement for what they need on their list.
Okay.
For the next season, based on how their current season is going or how their current list is looking or where they see they can improve their squad.
So they're not really just asking you to go out and find us raw talent and they can mould it to themselves. They've got a little bit of an idea of what they want.
Not so much more recently. Probably in the earlier days, there was a certain element of raw talent, and that's also, I suppose, that was because of the talent pool that was available in Australia, which when the competition started was much smaller.
Yeah.
Because when AFLW started in 2017, I suppose there was no formal competitions for girls whatsoever. You know, once you got to 12, you played with boys till you were 12 or 13, and then that was it. Girls just fell out of footy altogether.
Wow.
So when AFLW started, obviously that created an interest, but initially then there was that gap where suddenly you had, I think, whatever, 10 teams the first year were trying to recruit players. You were trying to get players that were just playing other sports in a lot of cases, or playing adult footy, to come and suddenly be a professional athlete, for want of a better description. So there was a gap in the talent pool, is what we'd say there. So that's where the initial demand for Irish players came from, and that's what I would have identified potentially initially and started putting Irish players forward and getting their information out there. Now, more recently, I guess the talent in Australia is phenomenal, the younger players coming through. So I suppose we fast forward 8 years, girls that might have been 10 or 11 watching AFLW when it started in Australia suddenly started playing, and now they've been playing for 7 or 8 years.
So, and they have local clubs that they can go to.
Oh yeah, the growth in the sport has been phenomenal. You know, I think there's 400,000 plus under 18 players in Australia at the moment. Like, you know,
coming from nothing 8 years
coming
ago.
Coming from nothing. So that pool is now there, and these girls are playing football for 5 or 6 years, and when they get to like 18, which is generally the draft age, there's generally a huge amount of talent coming through. So that has impacted a little bit. So some of the Irish talent ID is a bit more, I suppose, tailored and specific, but there's always going to be like opportunities for certain players or certain type of players going forward. And there's other things happening across the next couple of years now in terms of further expansion with a new team coming in 2028, Tasmanian Devils, and the potential, I feel personally, for squad sizes to get bigger and when the current collective bargaining agreement ends in 2027. So there's a lot of things on the horizon that might lead to, I suppose, more numbers being required again in the short term.
And the Devils, they spoke about creating a pipeline from Ireland, didn't they, to get Irish talent for both the men's and women's team over there?
Yeah, I think, look, they're in a unique situation in that they're a brand new club starting from scratch. You know, at the moment, I think they're starting to try and build squads to play in the VFL and VFLW competitions in Australia next year. Nothing has been set in stone yet, I'd imagine, but I'm sure there will have to be some dispensations from the AFL to a new club as to how they're going to get their talent. But yeah, very excited that we will see a lot of Irish players going to the Tasmanian Devils. I'm already chatting to them at the minute, and I know they're active in that space. But, you know, that's probably 3 years down the line, maybe 2028 is the season, so possibly an opportunity for younger Irish players here, which is really exciting.
God, if they put it on, I know a lot of the regional work in Tasmania counts for visas. They could nearly put footy on that requirement
list. Oh, would that be good?
They won't be shy of filling that anytime soon.
If you had
soon.
Your 88 days covered playing footy, that'd be unreal, yeah.
I thought I got away with murder working in a cafe and not in a field, so...
You did? Yeah.
So in terms of when you're doing the talent ID, are you going around to games across the country? Are you watching like film tape, live streams? Is that what you're doing?
A mix of everything, yeah. You know, getting to as many games as possible, and that's a mix of club games, university games when the O'Connor Cup is on, county games, and that's all through the year, from, you know, the National League in January to the Provincial Championships in May through to the All-Irelands, and then it switches over to clubs, which we're in right now, so we're getting to see as many club matches as possible. And then, of course, with streaming and, you know, games being available on TG4 and all these brilliant services, we're able to see a lot more, obviously, as well. But yeah, nothing beats getting around to the grounds and getting out and seeing the actual players in action, be it for their club, uni or county.
I think there's a Carrigtwohill Junior ladies footballers are playing championship on Friday if you want to pop down.
I'd have a look at the diary for sure, yeah.
And so in terms of like skills, why are the Irish players so successful? Like it's not talking about going over there and filling up a spot on the bench. Like they take up a proper spot in the roster and they excel over there. Why is that?
Yeah, well just to emphasise that point, I suppose that's very important as well. You know, with the women's programme, currently there's 30 squad spots at each club. If an Irish player goes over, she takes one of those 30 spots. You know, so it's not like there's an extra special spot for an Irish player. They're taking a main roster spot. With the male players, it's slightly different. There's a special category for players coming internationally from Ireland called Category B rookies. So if you ever see a club taking maybe two young Irish guys, they're not in their main squad, they're kind of extra spots. It's almost like a shot to nothing or a gamble that the clubs are facilitated to take. So always, in all cases, you know, when a club is bringing an Irish player over, they're doing it for that player to make as instant an impact as possible, and with the view that they're going to play in the team straight away, you know, as opposed to nobody has ever looked for a player to fill a number for sure. So that's without question. I suppose some of the basic skills from LGFA and Camogie to a certain extent are obviously transferable. You know, you've got a kick, you've got a catch, you've got a hand pass. But more so than that, I suppose the athleticism of the players and the level that they train to and play at for is professional, in my view, in all aspects, except they don't get paid, obviously. You know, professional except it's amateur. You know, the hours they put in, you know yourself, the training that's done, the commitment. It's crazy to think that it's probably costing the players money here in Ireland to do that. So, you know, they're really operating at this really elite level of athleticism, and that's something that really factors into it as well, you know, because AFLW is a game where it's like end to end, there's a lot of transitional stuff, there's a lot of K's clocked per game, so that ability to run, endurance, speed, agility factors into it as much as the skills does. But those kind of base transferable skills from here make it easier for the Irish players to transfer to the game when they get over there. And obviously we do a lot of work with them here at home with the oval ball as well before they actually get to Australia as well.
Yeah, so what do you think is the most difficult adaptation to manage going from ladies football to AFL?
Well, all the players will tell you, bouncing the ball. Like, I'm doing sessions with players, trying to get them doing basic kicks and handballs and marks, and they're like, I want to bounce it, I want to bounce it. And I'm like, you don't need to worry about bouncing it for a year. Like,
okay.
Now, it's the least important skill, but it's the one that most people want to try, because it looks pretty good when you bounce that ball. But
they'll be doing the Ash Central bounce now soon.
If they got the basic bounce down first, yeah, but obviously you see the power of, you know, a new player like Ash Centra, and the publicity that she's got in the last couple of weeks with the Ash Centra bounce has been phenomenal. Stuff like that is great for the game. But yeah, they all want to bounce the ball. It's incredibly hard to do it. I'd say probably the hardest thing to adapt to is the tackle. Obviously, you know, a full-on tackle from your shoulder to your knees and from 360, that's the hardest thing to get used to, you know, because obviously, even though LGFA is officially non-contact, it is contact sport. There is tackles, there is physicality, some games more than others. But the tackle, you can't practice for that until you get there and you're in the midst of it, I guess. And it's a specialised technique. There is specialised training around it and that. But I think most players remember getting their first tackle when they're in there. I think it was Grace Kelly a couple of years ago said she remembered just getting landed on her ass in the first tackle and went, was in shell shock, but straight away flipped her. Okay, I'm doing that back to you next.
Yeah, yeah.
So you just got to get up and get on with it. Yeah, so obviously getting used to the football, the shape of it, and kicking, and it's a lot more, everything's a lot more straight on than LGFA, where we tend to kick around the house a bit.
You see that a lot with Cora Staunton at the start, didn't you?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting story in itself, of course, like, you know, because one of the things, obviously, all of the clubs want the Irish players to use their natural weapons and stuff, and that GAA kick, that hook kick, is brilliant. Like, we see so many of the players using it really effectively now and across the board. You know, they kick it longer than the Aussies. It's unexpected. A lot of the Aussies haven't perfected that kick yet. You see the likes of Orla O'Dwyer just running down the left wing, hooking it with her left foot 40, 50 metres forward for the last few years has been phenomenal. But Cora did it because she was too stubborn to kick it the proper way back in year one. I hope she doesn't mind me saying that. But, like, I suppose that was a phenomenal story and her success in AFLW. But she went over at such short notice. She was the first Irish player to go over there from here. Specifically, Laura Corrigan was there for season one. Cora joined her in season two. But I think, like, she had such a short lead-in to the first games of that competition that she was literally like, no. They were trying to get her to kick it, punt it straight. And she was like, no, I'm going to kick it the way I'm used. For the first year anyway, she definitely got more standard in the Aussie kick from the years on, but it didn't matter. Look, she got 50 games plus. Yeah, 50 games plus, legend of the game. But I suppose that's one of the trickier things to get used to.
And so what would maybe an initial training session with yourself look like for someone who's never even touched a footy before?
Yeah, well, it's literally right back to basics. You know, you can nearly break it down into four different segments: kicking the ball, handballing, marking, and ground ball is very important. That's, I suppose, an area that we do a lot of focus on with AFLW, because the ball is on the ground a lot, and because of the shape of the ball, it's so unpredictable. You know, it can go any which way or any which angle when it hits the ground. So we tend to break it down into those four sections pretty much, and just work through the basics. You know, get a kicking technique, get the handballing technique down. Both of those are very straight on. The ball is straight, you're straight on your target. That takes a lot of getting used to. Then marking the ball, which is obviously similar. There'll be fielding. When the Irish girls talk about fielding in Australia, nobody knows what they're saying. You know, what are you talking about?
Farmers.
Yeah, the farmers, yeah. So marking the ball, it obviously takes a bit of getting used to as well, because the shirn tends to hang in the air a little bit longer, so you just got to judge the flight of that. And then ground ball. It's just a lot of repetition on ground ball. You know, even some of the players that have been over there for 5 or 6 years, if they're over here for their couple of months in the winter time and the club coach is talking to me, he'll say, just get out and do some ground ball with them, even though they've played for 5 or 6 years. So that never ends. But with all of the basic skills, it's all just repetition and just banking, like memory bank, and just getting stuff done. Repetition. You know, before every AFLW session, even now in Australia, they'll go out and they'll work on craft at the start of the session. They'll do 5 or 10 minutes of just kicking over and back, just handballing over and back. So that never changes. So yeah, we tend to break it down into those four basic skills and just get the player used to that. And no one's going to nail it immediately, obviously, and that can lead to a bit of frustration as well. But focus on the basics and take it from there.
Was there one player that stands out to you that did just get it faster than anybody else?
Oh, there was probably a few, and everybody got there in their own time eventually, but, like, I think, you know, Bláthain Macken from Armagh was absolutely amazing. First session, first kick, first 5 minutes, we were videoing stuff and we're like, we've got enough, you know, done.
Highlight reel is done
after 5 minutes. Normally you're leaving the video till the end of a 90-minute session, you know. But yeah, obviously, like, and her sister Amy as well, we were up there kicking in Armagh one day and she was just pinging goals from every angle, you know. So obviously natural athletes are able to adopt. But it's just something that clicks. You know, a lot of the players, it takes a half an hour, a couple of days. It doesn't matter. It all gets there in the end. It's just about adjusting that technique. But yeah, some of the players have taken to it pretty instantly. All right.
And probably a topic you don't want to broach as much, but you speak about 39 players going over this year. That's obviously 39 of the best players in the country.
Yes, yep.
Not playing in the LGFA. Do you get any grief for that?
So, like, in the main, over the last number of years, it's been generally very positive. That's been honest. Maybe they haven't found me yet. Hopefully they might find me after this interview a little easier. But no, I think, you know, the crossover in seasons across the last couple of years has made it more of a topic of conversation, without question, right? Probably most notably last year, or 2022, when there was two seasons. Basically, they changed the full schedule. They had two seasons in 1 year, and that fully changed the time that AFLW happened. Prior to that, the Irish players were pretty much able to play 6 months here, play a full competition, play the All-Ireland final, and then head out and play 6 months from November to March or whatever, yeah? Then they changed it that it was kind of starting in September and running to December, and that started to cross over. Pre-season of that started to cross over with the competitions here at home, obviously. Still, it was manageable to a certain extent,
yeah.
And it'll always be on a player-by-player basis as well, by the way. You know, certainly with the new players, if you're a first-year player going to a club, they're going to want you out as soon as possible to be there for all, if not the most part of pre-season. If you're a seasoned campaigner like Sinead Goldrick, Vicky Wall, you can stay on here and play through till your county is finished and then go out and still slot straight back in, yeah, seamlessly. But
do you think those days are numbered of players being able to do both?
Well, to finish out that point, I suppose this year, then the competition expanded in Australia, right? So we had two extra weeks of competition. Last year we had 11 games in 10 weeks, which was kind of a condensed fixture, which didn't really work. This year we've got 12 games in 12 weeks. So 2 extra weeks of competition equals 2 extra weeks of preseason. So that brought the start of everything officially forward 1 month. Okay, so the start of preseason this year was the 12th of May, which last year it was around the middle of June, I think. So that's a substantial difference, yeah? So what we had was a lot of the recruiting work for this year was done late last year, probably around this time last year, you know, August, September. We had 10 new players, I think, agreed to go to Australia. The dates changed. We had to sit back down with every single one of those players and every single one of those clubs and have some serious conversations about when players were able to come out. 9 of those players had to adjust their departure date and did so. But what that meant was that, you know, on a case-by-case basis again, some players played the National League and went out after the league finals on the 4th of April, I think it was. Some players played their provincial championships and went out at the end of May, and some players were allowed to stay on, mainly established players, with the exception of Eamon Cleary from Meath, who was the first Irish player at Richmond, actually, and they got all the way to the All-Ireland final as well. So, obviously, yeah, that greater crossover is leading to, I suppose, bigger questions being asked of the players. But I think, you know, once you go and get yourself established or have a good first season, you know, that's conversations we continuously have with the clubs. We're negotiating for the following year already, saying, okay, she's had a great year. Can we let her play here at home in the championship part of the year, all of the year? So, yeah, it's ongoing. And in some cases, then I guess some of the players after a couple of years will naturally tend to stay out there themselves to focus on AFLW, because the other side of it is that if you don't play a full season or you don't have that full block of 12 or 14 weeks of prep, players realise that it does impact on your ability to get into the team and, yeah, to, you know, just get used to the game, the rules, the structures, the language. So we do see that a lot of players tend to stay out for full pre-seasons their second or third year.
Yeah.
I suppose two examples of that would be Bláthnaid Bogue is the perfect example this year. You know, went out last year after the All-Ireland final. They won it with Fermanagh in Croke Park, the junior final. Was up there a great day, and she flew out a few days later. Didn't play at all last year with North Melbourne. But they were just taking their time with her until she was ready. And this year she's already scored like 6 goals in the first 3 rounds and is absolutely yeah, flying it. Yeah. You know, the same with probably Jennifer Dunn, winning All-Ireland and a premiership in the same year. The only player ever to do it. Absolutely amazing achievement. But she stayed out for full preseason this year as well, you know, wanting to just focus fully on AFLW. So there's a range of different scenarios.
Yeah. Is there anything, do you think, that LGFA can learn from the AFLW? We spoke a lot, even on the show this year, about the need to bring more physicality into the game, and that players like Vicky Wall are getting frustrated when they're playing ladies football because non-contact doesn't, yep, seem to cut the mustard anymore. You know, is there anything they can learn from if they were potentially to make some rule changes, and as well just how they've grown the game? You know, 2 more rounds this year than last year. If we want to grow ladies football in Ireland, is there something we can learn?
Yeah, well, I think just on the rules initially, you know, frustrating for the players, frustrating to be watching it, like you're sitting in the stands going, how is that a free, you know?
Yeah.
And it's hard because they're playing within the letter of the law at the minute and stuff like that. But, you know, you can see the games are physical. So we know it's not going to be easy or quick to change anything in any of the GAA either. But I think it's definitely a conversation that has to be had. And you mentioned, I suppose, Vicky is the standout example in all cases. That, you know, she spends half the game going around her hands up in the air going, yeah, what am I supposed to do, you know? And she's just a joy to watch. In AFLW, they absolutely love that. Like, she's just a tackling machine, like, you know. So
it's rewarded.
It's rewarded, yeah, every time, you know. And her main role this year now is tackling and making an impact physically nearly, as opposed to scoreboard pressure. She still scores goals, but she's playing like a more physical role, which suits her down to the ground. So yeah, you think there has to be conversations around that, but I suppose, again, just aspects you can take from it is like just the general professionalism around setups and that now. And I think a lot of counties have made huge leaps across the last few years. I'm sure not all of them have yet and are playing catch up a little bit, but just in terms of the support that's there, the background teams, the conditions. And that's the other thing that's interesting. It's a part of the conversation that people don't have much, but when the Irish AFLW players come home and they've finished their cycle in Australia and they're playing here, they're bringing those standards back to their counties and their clubs.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're demanding higher standards of training and they're lifting the standards around them and stuff. You know, like, perfect examples of that are the likes of Aisling Sheridan coming back to Cavan. They've had the most successful year in a long time this year. Kate Flood back to Louth. They won the All-Ireland this year a few weeks ago as well. So that's the other side of it. You know, it's not just a never-ending one-way street. Players are coming to the end of their cycles. Some of the players that have been there since we started back in 2017, 18, 19 have now been there 6 or 7 seasons, you know.
Yeah.
So at some point they're the Aussies hope they'll never retire, but at some point they're probably realistically going to retire and move on with their life. And some of the players have got engaged in the last few months and stuff like that, so life goes on. So we are going to see, I suppose, the end of a cycle where players are coming home and bringing those, you know, standards and attributes and that elite mindset to the players they play with here, and I think that's a positive.
Yeah. Do you ever get the feeling from the Australian side that the Irish girls are almost seen as a threat when they come over, and that we might see something like a cap on the amount of international players as the game grows in Australia?
Yeah, very rarely. As with anything, you'll see the odd comments. Every time we announce a player is signed or whatever, you'll get someone saying, oh, this could have gone to a girl down the road in Melbourne or whatever, you know. And like, normally you see Aussie people in defending and going, well, look, mate, if she's good enough to play, she'll play. Like, they're not,
yeah,
and it's what we touched on earlier, they're not taking a spot off anybody. You know, they deserve to be there because of on their abilities and stuff, you know. But I think overwhelmingly in general, people are in awe of what they're bringing to the competition. You know, I think this week alone in the top 8 or 9 overall AFLW fantasy points, the top 7 were Irish players, you know, in one round. So they're dominating. Like, I'm not afraid to say that. They're absolutely dominating it out there. So I think that, you know, quashes any little bit of negativity, because they're bringing so much to the competition and they are lifting AFLW as a whole, the Irish group that's over there.
Yeah, okay, so they're received positively over there.
Oh, overwhelmingly, yeah. Bar a couple of comments here and there, as you'll get everywhere and anywhere with any sport, women's sport, male sport, it's overwhelming experience, yeah. And, you know, the other thing that's hugely different about AFLW, and it comes back maybe to culturally as well, is not alone at matches, but at training. You know, there's people around the whole ground at the end of training. The players stay out there for a half an hour. They're taking pictures, they're doing autographs, they're signing jerseys. Kids are there. There's that whole level of interaction that you don't see even so much in the men's, and that has brought that far greater level of connection, I think, between supporters and the players and the game as well.
Something like what we're seeing at the moment with the Rugby World Cup, especially with the Red Roses. And
I was about to say, you know, yeah, and social media and how they're embracing that. You know, it's definitely the way forward. You know, that extra level of interaction and where the fans can feel a part of it or whatever. But yeah, in Australia, you know, there's Irish fans that have been in Australia for 20, 30, 40 years that travel every game with tricolours and stuff. And that's amazing to see, you know. And the players are brilliant. You know, they really are amazing ambassadors for our country as well, every single one of them.
Yeah, because it's not an easy move to make, like, athletic ability aside. Is there something that the clubs test character-wise?
Oh, 100%. You know? Okay, so athletic ability, if we go back to the talent ID and recruiting and getting professional contracts and stuff, and I say this straight out to the players, athletic ability is probably 50% of it. You know, there's that much weight paid to, you know, a person's personality, their mentality, their mindset, their character. Absolutely, you know. So like, when we ID players that are potentially interested in going to Australia and that clubs are potentially interested in talking to them, we obviously set up a series of meetings. You know, initially there'll be an intro meeting, but that could run from 1 to 5 meetings, where a player is meeting, you know, 1 or 2 people initially, right up there might be 7 or 8 people from the club on the 3rd or 4th call, and club psychologists, everybody's in there assessing this player's ability to make the journey 15,000-16,000 kilometers away from home, away from family, joining with a group of 29 other girls that in the main she's never met before,
yeah,
and become part of that, I suppose, team machine immediately. So that is a massive element of it, yeah. So again, you know, there have been a couple of players over the years that might have been identified as being good enough to play, but mightn't have passed the tests in terms of, you know, having that professional mindset as well, which is interesting, you know. So it's not for everybody either.
Yeah, and just to go back, touch on the Instagram effect. Obviously, the AFLW Ireland page is how most people probably know you, the alias. It's incredible, the amount of followers you have, the amount of engagement you get on every post. My favourite ones are probably the debutante announcements where their parents come over and surprise them. It's like the only situation where the Irish people aren't going home to surprise the parents at Christmas. It's the opposite
it's the
way
opposite.
Around.
Yeah.
Is there like a real community feel to the Irish players that are over in Australia together?
100%. You know, and it's absolutely unbelievable. Like, this is probably the busiest time of the year when the season starts and stuff. But I think one of the girls just told me there's a million views on the page in the last 4 weeks. And I'm like, holy moly, you know. So, like, now a lot of effort goes into keeping it updated and there's a few people involved in that. But, you know, it's huge. The interest and the support. We love the debut announcements, you know.
I'd be crying at half of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Me too. Yeah, you know, and there's a bit of work involved with the clubs and the PDMs at the clubs in getting the families out, which is a special part of it. You know, it was something that was done kind of ad hoc on a club-by-club basis 2 or 3 years ago, but with the new CBA that I keep talking about, that became mandatory that two family tickets were available to each player, so that's part of each player's negotiated contract. So it's less harder to make it a surprise, but still in a lot of cases do manage to pull off a surprise. But yeah, there's nothing better than seeing like two members of a player's family or more in the rooms when they're announced, or, you know, even announcing, we saw Kayleigh Cronin's family and dogs at home in Kerry telling her she was playing. And these are all phenomenal moments, because the other thing, it comes back, I suppose, to the character and the humility of the Irish players as well, and how down to earth they all are. Like, I send everybody over saying she's going to play round one, but every player goes over thinking they're not going to play a game. You know, it's crazy, but that's what makes them so good. So when they do get that debut announcement, and it is early in the season, you know, round one, two, and three, we had 9 new Irish players this year, and 7 of them have made their debuts now by round 3. So that, again, that's unheard of, you know, for only playing the sport maybe 2 or 3 months. You know, so
speaks to the quality that's going over.
Speaks to the quality, yeah, and the impact they make and how hard they work when they do get over there. You know, we know officially, I think it's 22 hours per week the players are in the club, but I know the Irish girls are in there every day. You know, they're dragging coaches out onto the pitch or onto the Astro for a half an hour of extra kicking. They're going into the video suite to watch games. They just put in so much work outside of the actual official sessions and stuff like that, and they get rewarded for it. It's great to see it.
Yeah, so you mentioned that, like, 22 hours. In terms of contracts, obviously they've evolved immeasurably, especially over the last couple of years.
Yep.
They're full-time, part-time contracts that the girls are on now over there. What is it generally?
So basically, first of all, to give you an idea of where it's come from, I suppose we mentioned Cora the Legend a while ago. When she went in 2017, it was $14,000 was the payment for an AFLW player, okay? Still better than nothing for playing sports, yeah? But this year it's, next year coming 2026, it's $70,000 for a first-year player. Now it's a tiered system, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4 tiers, and generally it breaks down, there's 2 players from each club on tier 1, 6 on tier 2, 6 on tier 3, and the balance are on tier 4. So your kind of standard contract is that tier 4 basic $70,000. Some of the Irish girls go over on better than that, and that's part of the work that we do, obviously. And some of the players that have been there a number of years are on much better than that, you know. So like the top tier contract is $102,000, I think, and there was studies published recently that showed the top 4 or 5 players in AFLW are getting in the region of $150,000 to $200,000.
We'll do a couple of sessions there. They're really giving up the scratch.
Absolutely. And you know, so in Australia they say it's semi-professional because and this is the beauty of it, for the Irish girls to go over, it's professional for them because they play football and then they're off, basically. But we're still at a stage where, because it's not fully professional yet, that some of the Australian players have day jobs, a bit like the LGFA players
kind of
here.
By choice.
Yeah, by choice, yeah. You know, the money is very good. It's again, up to a couple of seasons ago, as part of an Irish player going over, we were generally trying to negotiate a separate employment contract as well, where they might do some work a day or two a week just to supplement that income. Now, more so, the footy contract is enough to sustain a player over there comfortably for the amount of time that they're there, they might still choose to do some extra work just purely for something different. Or, you know, we're always encouraging the players to try and further their own professional development as well, if they've just finished uni, depending on what they studied and stuff. So, you know, the likes of Sarah Wall.
That'd be a terrifying combination, amalgamated of Sarah Rowe and Vicky Wall. It wouldn't be allowed.
No, Vicky Wall, Sarah Rowe have all worked in the commercial departments of their clubs. Anya Tai is kind of involved in community development and coaching at schools in Fremantle Dockers. Eric O'Shea has worked in the shop in North Melbourne and has been one of the most popular shop employees ever. You know, people coming in and she's selling them her own badge. So there's that there as well, and that's separate additional income. And as well as that basic salary, then there's the whole relocation and living package as well, that probably comes to another $20,000-$25,000 as well, between flights, rent, all of that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's definitely come a long way. That's set in stone until 2027, and then from 2027 on, at the moment we don't know. So the players are asking, I'm asking, the clubs are asking, what's going to happen after that? So there's going to be a whole other negotiation of how the next 2 or 3 years will work. But we're generally, there's a feeling that we're coming to a stage where salaries will be open salaries, so there won't be tiers anymore. Yep. It'll be more like the men's competition. So, but I suppose to put it in context, for an Irish player going over for the start of pre-season, start of May, if you don't make finals, you're finished the end of October. If you do make finals, you're finished the end of November. So 5 or 6 months,
you're getting nearly a yearly salary.
You're getting a year salary. Yeah. Yeah. So it is for the footy season, but it is spread across the year. It's an annual salary. Again, they used to just pay players from June to December. Yeah. But because of the Aussie players and the practicalities of trying to get mortgages and finance and stuff, they just spread the salary across 12 months. So it's officially a year contract, but you're playing for 6 months, basically.
Brilliant. And you mentioned maybe trying to make a bit more similar to the men's. A question on a lot of people's lips here for both the men's and women's is an international series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is it something you'd like to see?
Absolutely. I've been pushing for that for 5 or 6 years at this stage now. So
how would it look for you? Well, in an ideal world.
This is really interesting because it can look a lot of different ways. Okay, now the good news is conversations have happened around that. Certainly, there's initial dates penciled in for a men's competition next year for men to come over. Without question, if there's a men's series happening, there will be a women's series. They can't happen at the same time for practical reasons, so it would be a separate tour, I think. And I think initially, now none of this is set in stone, but like it's ongoing, but I think initially Australia might come to Ireland. I always get asked how it might look. You know, everyone says because we've got 39 Irish players in Australia, we've got an Irish team over there, basically, you know. So
yeah,
theoretically, the AFL could organise a test match between Ireland and Australia. They're all their own contracted players, basically, you know, without ever asking us here, which would not be good, obviously. In theory, nobody has suggested that, by the way. But I think if it was to go ahead as a series between the LGFA and the AFL, AFLW, I think the majority of players would probably be Irish-based players here at home, you know, because otherwise...
And it'd be a more of a compromise rules.
Yes, yeah. I think so, yeah, because otherwise you could just flood the team with Australian players and there'd be no, I suppose, benefit for the players here at home. So who knows, but I think you could see an international rules series in Ireland between Australia and Ireland with predominantly Irish-based LGFA players. And the next time they go to Australia, there might be more of the AFLW girls involved, or at some point in the future. I would love to see Ireland versus Australia, AFLW, straight up, no compromise rules, you know.
Who do you think would win?
Oh, like, I would think it would be close. You know, everybody will tell me Australia are going to win it, but I think at this stage, we could even have a big shock there, like, you know. More so, initially, there was probably thoughts that there wasn't enough Irish players playing in key positions, but now, across the last few seasons, we have players in every position, pretty much. So I would love to see that one, yeah.
Do you think they might be a bit reluctant to do it in case
yes.
that does happen?
I think there's your answer. That's why it mightn't happen, you know. But yeah, that would be whatever format it would be in. Compromise rules here in Australia, AFL in Australia, it would be hugely support. There's no doubt about that. So like commercially and marketability wise, it'd be a winner. So I think it makes sense. But again, as per everything, these things take time. But the conversations are happening, which is very exciting.
Brilliant. Excellent. Mike, thanks so much for talking to us.
No worries. Thanks, Mill.